Today's program has been brought to you by Calavita. Think outside the bottle with Calavita, America's trusted family brand, makers of extra virgin olive oil and fine Italian food products. Calavita.com.
You're listening to Heritage Radio Network. We're a member-supported food radio network broadcasting over 35 weekly shows live from Bushwick, Brooklyn. Join our hosts as they lead you through the world of craft brewing, behind the scenes of the restaurant industry, inside the battle over school food, and beyond. Find us at heritageradionetwork.org.
Hey, Michael Omeka here. We're doing a selfie. Yes, sir. We're doing a selfie. We've got a fun show today. I told you last week, I warned you, if you're not into wine, you're not going to dig this. So that's, you know what? Get into wine. If you're into food, not into wine, there's something basically wrong. I've got a great show today. I'm not going to have him live for another 3 minutes, because once he and I go, it's going to be like, it's like being at the top of a long slope, and then you get your skis, you dig in, and you go, we're off. And it's just going to keep going. Fred Dexheimer, Master Somm, another week with a great wine person in the house here. I just can't resist. But first, a shout-out. Two places I went to this week for the first time, both of them. A while back, I had Ryan Sutton on, who is the food critic for Eater before that he was with Bloomberg. He's a great voice in this city. He sort of covers the high-end New York scene for Eater. And he was raving about Olmsted in Brooklyn, raving. So I actually finally got someone to pull some strings, got a table, went there on Tuesday night. And I have to tell you, it is all that. It's crazy. It's this great neighborhood restaurant, open kitchen, typical restaurant space, long, narrow, a back garden that they use for both growing herbs and stuff, and also for seating people. I think the guy worked at Alinea. He worked at Per Se, like badass resume. And the food was just freaking fantastic. There was a trout dish. I usually don't like sweetwater fish. I'm like a saltwater guy. So trout usually tastes to me like mud, like dirt. Tastes like what it eats. But they had this great trout dish where there was a boneless fillet. They put it skin side up under the salamander till the skin turns into flame. Then they take it out, peel the skin off, let it continue cooking. Covered it with grated raw almonds, some roasted Brussels sprouts, and a lot of butter. And it was so freaking good. And then they did a rutabaga, like a tagliatella on a spiralizer rutabaga. That was, I mean, everything was great. You ever been to Olmsted, Fred? No, you haven't been there yet.
No, but you make me want to eat dirt right now. It sounds so good.
It was great. It was just a little. It's completely packed place, and it was funny. We get to the end, and they say, you want to do dessert? And someone at the table said, yeah, I want to do the s'mores. So for the s'mores, they take you in the back garden. This is so hipster Brooklyn. They take you in the back garden. They give you these twigs with whittled down points at the end as if you're at a campfire. They've got these little flames going over some kind of charcoal, and you roast your own homemade marshmallows with graham crackers and Hershey's chocolate. That was kind of silly. But otherwise, Olmsted is great. If you can get in, go. And the prices, I think that's the best thing about it. It's like, it's really like super fine dining, but kind of casual-ish. And the prices are like in the teens and low 20s. So I would advise you to get three courses, and if you don't drink a lot of wine, you can get out of there for 50, 60 bucks a person and eat like kings. And then the next day, speaking of kings, next day, I was at Peoria a few weeks ago that I loved, and Victoria James, who's the somm there, said, you've got to try this restaurant, and I have heard about it. It's called King. It's on King Street, not lower Manhattan, lower Greenwich Village, south of Houston Street, but on the west side of Houston. Just one of those little West Village streets that you wouldn't know about, off 6th Avenue. A couple of British gals that used to work at the River Cafe in London, which is, you know, Michelin-starred restaurant. And it was really, really good. Another one of these new restaurants that have only been open for 6 months. They had this great scallop app with squid and beans, and I had an anglais, and they had a tongue that was braised. It was really, really good, so I really can't recommend that enough. King is amazing. It's on King Street, Lower Manhattan. You'll need a reservation because it's busy and they take reservations. And then last night I got to see Bill Frisell at the Village Vanguard. Every time Bill comes, I see him at least twice. He'll be there next week again. This was a trio. He killed it. One of my favorite guitarists. Like, I'm all into guys playing fast and shredding, and a lot of guitarists can't resist that. But Bill's proof that space and phrasing and subtlety sometimes trumps everything. He's one of my guitar gods. Anyway, in the house today, I think for the first time, were you over on Food Talk when I was at OR?
No, we were on the PBS show, though.
You were. That was the night. It was you, me. I was a show on Wine Bars.
Anya.
But it wasn't supposed to have been. It was supposed to have been...
Laura.
Laura Maniac. But she was working downtown at Fiamma. She couldn't get the night off, so she sent Anna in her to do her bidding. And it was a six-location shoot. It was like a 10-hour day. And at some point, you and Anna were kind of like not on the same page with the wines.
Yeah.
And
totally.
And then at some point further, we were all kind of wasted. And then by towards the end, it was... Like, just an argument. Like, I'm like, how are we going to edit this shit? Yeah. Like, you guys would open wines and just argue with each other.
Well, we were speaking Turkish by the end, I think. We went to that. We went to Frogs, Turks and Frogs and whatever, and we were drinking, like, Ozguskusu and Bokashkera and Karachekarasi, and we were totally out of our league there. We traveled all of Europe, all of South America, all of the United States. Our passport was punched to the max.
And we ended up at Casalula when Tia Keenan was still there as a fromager.
Incredible cheese program there. Yeah, it was
by that point, we were all pretty wasted.
We went to that South African place. So we drank incredible Chenin Blanc.
Steen, which is Chenin in South Africa.
Yeah, that was a good time.
Yeah, she was a hottie. I remember the name of that girl, but she was, I think the place is still there.
Yeah, I forget what it's called, but it was amazing.
Me neither. It was named after for a beach in South Africa, but I wouldn't know. So, Fred Dex, talk to me. You're from Pennsylvania somewhere, but not like Philly, like rural PA.
No, I'm from central PA, yeah.
Like, name the town.
Sunbury / Bloomsburg, and I grew up in a video arcade, so that's the thing you gotta understand. I literally grew up in the heyday of Pac-Man and Donkey Kong, before Nintendo, before Atari. I had pinball machines. We had every video. All the greatest video games on the planet.
It's a great way to spend youth.
Yeah, and then we turned it into a video store. You know, we were on the cusp of VHS. So, like, I grew up with movies.
Like Tarantino.
Yeah. So, you know, I took a wrong turn at Albuquerque. I should have been a film guy or an actor. But now here we are as a master sommelier, like, you know, charting the world's greatest wines, right?
When I met you first, you were working on the floor for Lauren Turrendale.
Yep.
So you're the beverage guy, and he had three or four locations by that point already.
Yeah, you came to Prime the first time. That was our third place, yeah.
I came to Prime. You were not yet a master som.
No, I had taken the advanced, and that's about as far as I was at that point. But I might have taken the master. I had taken the master, I think, once. And I swung the bat. You know, at three pitches that were, you know, weren't strikes. And, I went to the dugout with my head hanging high.
Hold on. But so you're not, we have had Laura Maniac on the show. We've had Roger Daggett on the show. We've had Pascaline. I mean, there's 123 or 124 Master Soms in the country.
About buck 50. 150 and 230 in the world.
150 now, okay.
Yeah, yeah.
150.
Yeah, somewhere around
there. By the way, this is delicious.
Oh, yeah. That's the Ziggity, my man. That's Ziggity Rosé from Austria. I mean, people talk about Prosecco. People talk about Cava. We have this stuff. It's so incredible. It's through one of our importers. Austrian. Basically, it's the same price as like Cava. It's in that Cava Prosecco range.
Like high teens, low 20s.
Yeah. And this is delicious. Rosé.
Really nice. Really fine mousse.
It's called Ziggity. Like
Ziggity, like just Ziggity, like Ziggity dog.
If all we need is a rapper to be like, I'm getting Ziggity on the rosé.
It's
with my brosés,
and it's kind of it's kind of saline, or is that me?
That's just you, but
just me. All right,
you're just a
me.
Salty dog, man. Yeah, you're like a surfer.
I haven't had anything to eat all day, so yeah. I just came out of the pool. So this post workout salt.
Yeah, no, you eat too much.
So the master something. So to give everybody an idea, so there's 150 now, but this is a program that's going on since
I was
the
number 80s. 79 in the United States,
and Roger Daggett was one of the real early ones because I
he
got
was
to work
like
with
number
him.
Negative zero. Like, yeah, he's like there's AD and then
Yoda.
there's like BR before Roger. You know, that's kind of Roger was one of the original. He is like Yoda. He's a sake samurai. He's one of the most elegant, eloquent, and just
soft-spoken. Yoda-esque in that he's like 5'4". He wears ill-fitting suits.
But if he pulls out the lightsaber,
forget about it. You want to talk about wine or sake? Forget about it. You are dead.
You're dead. Just, you're dead in the water. Yeah, like I got nothing. Nothing on him.
So you were taking your courses now. To give everyone an idea, again, how hard this is. Last year, I was filming. There's a wine bar down on Center Street called Compagnie
de Vin with Caleb. Caleb's awesome.
Super wine program. I really like the food. These guys get kind of 11 mad, and the wine list is off the hook. So we're filming there, and I want Pasca to come down to be on camera with me, just because I always want Pasca to be on. So Pasca comes down to talk about something.
Well, it makes you look authentic, you know? The French.
Makes you look authentic. Her and I had like this romance love affair thing going too. Lots of touching, lots of hugging. So anyway, the day we were filming was the day that test was being done, whatever it was, last May or something. And the results came in on her phone, because of course they would.
Yeah, and we have a network, and you get the email.
62 of the best Psalms, because to even get invited to do this, you've got to be a badass. 62 of the best from Canada and America took the test, and I believe 3 passed.
That sounds about right.
Fuck.
Yeah.
That's what it's like.
That's 4.3%.
Correct. It's just insane.
It's not quite 5.
So Laura Maniac told me that her Achilles heel was service.
Yeah.
That she really got nervous about the service. So she took it once. Nope. Flunked service. Twice. Flunked service. For the third time, she hired somebody, like a personal guru-y trainer, to film her, to get her like in a comfort zone.
Yeah.
Here's what you're doing wrong. Let's work. And she spent like 6 months just working on like presentation for front of the house so she would not. And that was what it took for her.
Yeah.
Well, were you working with people? Because everyone I know that does this, they would have a group of Psalms. They would get together on like an off week night during that year, like the movie.
Yeah.
And they would blind taste each other. Was anybody you were working with? Was it like a Rat Pack of Psalms?
Well, let me start from the beginning, so to speak. So, you know, as a career restaurant person, let's just start with this. As a career restaurant person, you're a career chef and got into media and these type of things. You know, I decided pretty quickly that restaurant was the way I was going to go. So like, you know, and I was a waiter, a cook, this and that and the other thing. And then I found out about wine, and all of a sudden it's like, there's something here. And if you know something about wine, all of a sudden people spend more money. Number one. Number two. Cappiello
said the same thing.
Check average goes up. Yeah. Your tips go up.
Right.
And I'll tell you a funny story about that, because you and I both had a ponytail one time and we were chasing girls and, you know, smoking weed and trying to just, you know, impress people and throw parties and have fun and
the ponytail
dance on the ceiling kind of thing. So, you know, I realized I was working in Vermont, and not only did I make more money, I got respect at the table. So if I could say something about whether it was Ferrari Carano Chardonnay or, you know, right, the Chilean Cabernet Merlot blend before they knew that all was Carmenere, which we could talk about too, and the Magnum was this, like, the, you know, people, I was a 20-year-old ponytail, ski bummy, drummer kid, and they're like, oh, man, you know your shit. And I was like, yeah, I know my shit. And they're like, hey, we'll have another bottle of that. And, you know, and all of a sudden, you know, that $10 tip on a $50 check became an $80 check with a $20 tip. And they treated me like, you know, like I had, you know, in the service industry, waiters are sometimes dispensable, you know, dispensable heroes in a sense. It's a Metallica reference, by the way. you know, it's like, hey, just give me this, right? And if you actually have something to say and you can create an experience, and that's where I kind of,
right,
that's the kernel of it all. And through the years, I got some great opportunities, but, you know, I moved to New York, worked with Jean-Luc Ledoux, worked with Paul Greco.
You worked with Jean-Luc on the floor at Danielle?
Yes. Then Paul Greco at Gramercy.
And then
this is the golden era, like 2000, yeah, 2001, 2002.
This one's blowing up.
This one, and then the Psalm thing's blowing, yeah, up, but I was already on the trajectory. So, right, like, I was 23, 24 years old when I moved, 22, 23 when I moved to New York during the election. And I remember being in the kitchen of Danielle and being like, Gore, Bush, like, that was when I moved to New York, and it was like that was a defining moment.
They called Florida for Gore that night.
Yeah,
everybody celebrated. I was there that night, and I woke up hungover as fuck the next day.
Because you were
turned on the TV
and like,
what the hell?
There's no president.
Just right.
Yeah,
all the same newscasters, and I'm like, oh no.
No. So
anyway, so we were all right. So
yeah. So that's, you know, to give you an idea of my timeline,
right,
in New York, and then who I was working with. So I was working with Jean-Luc, who owns a great store down on Washington
actually. It's across from the old La Freda meat plant. I know it because I buy cases.
Yeah, but I mean, he's done an incredible job.
He's a badass.
He's a great guitarist also.
Yes.
And music guy, and then Yannick works with him, and then I work with Paul Greco as Terroir, and you know, then I work with Chris Cannon, who Limpero, you know, a slew of James Beard Awards. He's, yep, out in Morristown.
Correct.
With Jockey Hollow. Then I work with a guy named Chuck Simeon. So Chuck Simeon was the wine director for Be Our Guest, who's Laura's mentor, who she, one of the reasons she had problems with service is because she was thrust into a beverage director job. And I can define the difference between a sommelier and a beverage director. A beverage director is an admin and a decision making, and you know, you're making decisions based on, you know, bottom line decisions, product decisions, but you may not get out
on the floor
to talk to people. So
well, that's funny. I didn't know that.
No, there's compartmentalization. So then
you realize, so she never really spent much time.
She spent time, but she fast tracked
like,
a little bit.
Right, like leapfrogged over 10 years on the floor to being, you're good, 2 years on the floor.
Well, see, that's one of the things. So back to the Master Sommelier thing. So I kind of sped through the program quickly because I had street smarts. So I'm an only child. I grew up in a video arcade. You know, I run the roost of my little town, about 10,000 people.
Don't say you've got a great palate, you've got a great nose, you've got a great memory.
Well, street smarts, though. So this is what I'll tell
you.
You're
sitting down in front of those guys, and you got a blind taste, 3 reds and 3 whites, and fucking get them. That ain't street smarts. That's
training.
That's training. That's a palate, a tongue, a nose, memory, response.
Yeah, it's all trained. I grew up on cheeseburgers and pizza, man, in the middle of Pennsylvania. My family didn't drink wine. My mom drank Genesee cream ale.
Even though Pasco's from Loire, she wasn't really into restaurants until her 20s. She was a philosophy major.
Yeah, but you can take – so, you know, there's a couple different pieces of that, right? So she's a philosophy major. She's able to compartmentalize certain pieces of information and catalog it.
Remember
you. Well, you have to catalog it. Right. And this is kind of something that, you know, I learned from the first Sherlock Holmes book that Sir Arthur Conan Doyle wrote. He said the mind is not elastic. It's like an attic. And every piece of information has to be stored and organized appropriately. Now, in an attic, you have to...
I write shit down.
But in an attic, sometimes you got to go up there and throw some boxes away because you got to store some other things. So I learned through that quote how to know what I needed to know and know what shit was superfluous and, like, get out. Like, just get out of my mind. And I think some of the issue, and we can talk about that down the line, it's kind of a next-level issue, is a lot of kids in the programs, in the Sommelier programs, and the learning programs get caught up in, you know, superfluous knowledge. And you know this from cooking. It's all about the mother sauces. If you can nail the mother sauces, you know how to do certain techniques in cooking or even in bartending. If you know how to make a proper margarita, a proper Manhattan, and a proper, you know, now you can with egg white, if you can use that, and a proper French 75, and you nail it, You now the world is a possibility.
Right.
So what I learned is the core stuff, worked with some bad motherfuckers, worked in some of the greatest sellers in the planet.
I mean, tasting,
but also schlepping boxes,
right,
touching bottles, things I couldn't pronounce. You know, when you do an inventory, I remember doing, so I was talking to someone today about a gentleman named Craig Hanna. So for your audience, Craig Hanna runs the Wall Winnet in Nantucket, which is a, you know, Grand Award, 3-star Michelin, destination hotel, $1,000 a night. And he gave me a shot when I was in my early 20s, like 21, 22. I think I was 21. And he let me do inventory. And you're touching these bottles. And it's like, how do you pronounce this? He's like, oh, that's Gevrey Chambertin. How do you pronounce this? That's Chablis. I'm like, Chablis? You know, it was just something simple like that. So I got to touch thousands of bottles. And when I worked at Danielle, my job was cellar rat. My title, if I had a card, would have been Frederick Dexheimer. Cellar rat.
When Patrick was here, when I talked to Patrick, same story. Him at the Tribeca Grill.
Yeah.
Same story. Way back in the day.
Well, yeah, man. With just Marty and with Drew and David Gordon.
Doing the cellar. We're doing the cellar. I didn't order a bottle of wine for years. Just taste, inventory, taste.
Yeah, you put your head down and you literally, Mike, I would have to move. So, you know, you have these shelves, right? And everything's in like bin number order. So this is why I wanted to preface with the video store thing. Because the video store thing back then, remember, it was a catalog. Everything had a number. You remember going to the video store and picking the plastic thing and then bringing it to the counter. And then they would swap out the thing for the plastic case that protected the thing. And be kind, rewind.
Yeah, I was about to say, you had to return them and rewind and remember all this shit.
Yeah, I used to catalog all of the categories. So my mom let me catalog what was drama, what was thriller, what was horror, what was sci-fi, what was full, you know. And then I would catalog them into the number system. So I was already set up to do this. So, like, for me, it was, you know, when I started, like, organizing wine cellars.
Inventory was something you could do.
It was like, yeah, I got this. I spoke that language. It was like the Dewey Decimal System, right? Like, if you knew how to use the Dewey Decimal System.
Unfortunately, that's how we learned things in school.
Back in the day. So I get in the cellar of Danielle, and I'm literally moving 10 shelves up. 10 shelves of wine. And mind you, this is Grand Cru Burgundy and Premier Cru Burgundy. Moving maybe 100 bottles that may have a worth of 10 grand up one shelf so I could put in
the next thing.
The next thing. Right. I would spend hours I got paid to just move a shelf one up. So my tactile memory of the language of a label, how bottles feel, what, you know, who imports, what the feeling is, and the way, you know, this stuff and being in a and it was a dirt floor cellar. Like, this was dirt floor.
At Danielle.
Yeah, there was dirt floor in the periphery of it. And, you know, you're like four stories underground in, you know, the most expensive neighborhood in Manhattan.
Yeah.
Between Madison and Park and on 65th. So, you know, imagine you're 23 years old and that's what you're doing. And you're like, what the fuck? What? You don't even know. You're just like, I'm going through the – I'm going, right? I'm here. I'm going. And here we are, you know, 15 or so years later, right?
So was there a group of psalms you tasted with that you practiced with that you did your little weightlifting sessions?
Yeah, so but by and large, the first couple of years were on my own.
So what
this
was
is
your,
raw it was raw like
every
I'm gonna
glass
fuck
of what you're drinking now.
I'm gonna fuck the shit up.
What's next?
So we're gonna
was your week there's always something that you're not strong with. Was there something? No, there wasn't.
Not really.
You bastard.
So we're going to taste a Croatian wine. So I went to Croatia about a year and a half ago. This guy's a bad motherfucker.
This was the guy who had that tasting up at Bettany 6 months ago
for
Southwest France.
Yeah.
And I met, didn't I meet a guy there that's a Croatian wine guy?
Cliff. So I visited with Cliff, but Cliff kind of put me on a track. This is Bruno Trapan. He's in, and by the way, this is about 2 hours from Veneto. So if you think about Italy, what I learned about Croatia is you fly into Veneto and then you drive to, instead of going to Zagreb, Zagreb's further away. So this is Pula, which is on the Adriatic coast. This is Malvasia. This is tank fermented, a little bit of lee stirring, but this is coastal wine. Open some oysters, clams. I mean, this is, you have this ocean surf, you know, this is South Jersey wine right here. Because think of, you know, this is salty.
I bought a case of Bio Aligoté the other day. There was a producer in that was in town. It was all over last week and shit was amazing. I bought his young vines, which are 50 years old. And that's what I did. I burned on the case. I didn't even wrap it. I just wrote on it, summer wine.
Yeah.
That's perfect.
But this,
this is amazing. So
this is probably about $22, but not to digress from what you asked me. So the first 3-4 years, I was totally on my own because I didn't have master. So it's really important in the Master Sommelier program, right, to have a mentor or to have – you know, but you also, as a mentor, you need to have proteges because it works in both directions. Mm-hmm. And you know this as a chef. Mm-hmm. There's always someone that you can't beat, that's your beacon of light. And then there's always the sous chef that's hungry for the thing.
Right.
What, no matter what a sous chef should have line cooks. A line cook should have a prep cook all the way up and down. So you're learning and you're teaching. So I think there's a big part of that. That system of, you know, train the trainer, you know, kind of thing. But when I moved to New York, the first guy that helped me out was Willie Scher, is a master sommelier. And I'll give you the context and you'll know the context. L'atelier. So your kitchen, this is going to come home for you to roost.
Robichon.
No.
L'atelier.
Gabriel Croutier's first restaurant in New York City was at Central Park South, was L'atelier.
Where the hell?
59th.
Okay.
And he was the sommelier. He came from Vegas.
Okay.
Master sommelier, trained a lot of people.
Vegas has a lot of master sommeliers.
But he moved to New York. L'atelier was Gabriel Croutier's first restaurant before he did the modern.
Mm.
And that was in your kitchen. But that was your kitchen. You were CEPS, right? Or
I was in the Ritz-Carlton when it was on Central Park South.
That's the same kitchen. The restaurant that became BLT Market. Before that was L'atelier.
That's a different Ritz-Carlton. They moved the block down. We used to be in the middle of the block but by the athletic club.
Well,
Gabriel Cruz is an amazing chef. By the way, if you haven't been to restaurant Gabriel on Bryant Park, 42nd
amazing.
Street, it's ridiculous. That guy's technically awful. It's the kind of cooking I see less and less of anymore. It's necessary. Cooks are so technically proficient. Every dish is like so thought out. It works.
But it feels good.
It's a great room.
You know, it's not like, you know, what's the word? You can feel the love.
Yeah, and it's a great space, like 25-foot ceilings. What's your name on the floor? The French Emily Perrier runs right, great kid. So anyway, he was your guy.
So Willie Scher was the first guy when I moved to New York. So I worked with Chris. I worked with Paul, and Jean-Luc. I mean, I had a pretty good understanding after 2-3 years in New York of like how to be a wine dude in New York. But what I didn't have is a mentor for the master sommelier part.
Mm.
And at that time, there was really nobody. There was Roger, Scott, and they were kind of like unattainable, let's say, because who the fuck was I? And like, how do you get in touch with these guys? You got to like show up at the door. now you can like try to find them on Facebook or, you know, see them at an event and like be
it's
like
two totally different worlds.
Two different worlds. Right. So like literally I had to go out and like hit, you know, put, you know, my soles of my shoes had holes in them trying to figure out how to get to these things. So Willie helped me out a lot, and then we put together a tasting group. That tasting group was pretty badass. We, Bernie Sun was there. The first one we ever did was at the old Monrochet space, which became
Corton,
then became Batard. Yep. So we were in the, you know, in the guts of that place.
And Daniel Hannes, that's just got great lineage anyway.
Yeah, well, Daniel, well, yeah. So Daniel wasn't there at the time because he was doing his import thing, but Bernie Sun was the wine mm-hmm. director there at the time before he went on to Jean Georges. And so it was me and him and, you know, when Aldo moved here and a couple other, like it was a group of like really, and we started off with like, you know, a few of us and then it became this huge thing. But back to Laura Manick, Laura and I grew up together. So she and I kind of shared the same trajectory, but also in careers we say share the same trajectory because we both were beveraged. So we were SOMs or, you know, one unit SOM beverage manager. We had a contact with kind of the same mentor, Chuck. And then when we and she worked with Greg Harrington, who's one of the, you know, he owns Gramercy Cellars in Washington, and that was her mentor as well. And we've intersected, but the thing that we bonded on more in the MS thing was just the pain and the pain and the pleasure of having this amazing job where you're running 3, 4, 6, 8, 10 restaurants. And we would more talk about how to be buyers and what are our challenges and what are our opportunities for us in that particular role, buying wines for multiple units. How do you train staff? How do you maximize, you know, your buying power? Yeah. Who are you buying from? Who do you like? The business, you know, yeah. You know, how can we share concepts, ideas, and, you know, what are your challenges and how, you know, what are my challenges, and then trying to find, you know, solutions to some things that are stifling us. And then we had a little group for a little while, but really New York was a dearth of like that because Andrew Immer passed years ago and left. Scott kind of was on a, you know, Scott Carney, who now runs the International mm-hmm. Culinary Center. He runs an amazing sommelier program, intensive sommelier, and I'm an adjunct professor of that. But, you know, talk to Scott Carney was like, when you're 25 years old, you're like, you know, you're looking up at, you know, the giant.
Yep, yep.
And Roger, even though he's diminutive in size, it's like Andre Chelyshev, like he yes, was yes. 4 foot, you know, 11
chains.
It's like you're still looking right. up.
Yeah, these
like,
guys are just, they know everything.
Yeah, and that was, you know, and now being in the club, so to speak, I passed, I got the, you know, it's where, you know, there's
hugs. Third try.
So, you know, and then I met Richard Betts and I met some other guys. So it's a good story. I took the exam, right, and I totally knew I got smoked. Like, I knew it.
The first time?
Yeah, I knew it. So Wayne Belding called me. I was running BLT and we were just about to open Prime, and it was a blustery winter day, and the 6 train was my best friend because I could get to all the restaurants from the 6. So I would leave 57th Street BLT Steak. I could take the 6 on 53rd down to 22nd, 23rd, and go to Prime. Then I could just go to Union Square and go over to Fish. So we were in this like really beautiful line, and I get a phone call, and it says like Colorado, and this is before, this wasn't an iPhone. This was like a crappy Nokia, like 2005. And Wayne Belding's like, "Hey, Fred." Like, "Hey, who's this?" He's like, "It's Wayne Belding." And I'm like, "Oh shit, it's Wayne Belding." And he knows the story. It's great. So he's like, and this doesn't happen, by the way, anymore. Like, these spots are coveted. Like, you can't even get in anymore. Like, it's there's so many people. He's like, "We have a spot for the MS. Do you want to take it?" And I was like, I peed my pants and I like jumped for excitement, almost got hit by a cab. And meanwhile, it's January and it's like hailing, you know, and I'm like, "Yeah, let's go," you know, and I, you know, and he's like, "Well."
And it was for the next spring?
No.
A year?
No.
When?
3 weeks. So, yeah. So he's like, 3 weeks later, come and take the exam. But I had been doing a lot of competitions.
Right, of course.
Yeah. So I went to France and did a competition. I won Best Sommelier in the Northeast. I competed for Best Sommelier in the World. And I was connected. That's how I met Aldo. He was the Best Sommelier of Austria. And Andreas Larsen, who won Best Sommelier.
And Aldo is Aldo Somm, if you don't know. It's Bernadani.
Yeah, Le Bernadani has a little wine bar next door, which is incredible. Great people. I was like, "Yeah, I'll take it." And then I was literally like, "Oh shit, I'm not ready." But I went in. I got clobbered. But, you know, there's two ways to look at it, Mike. Two ways. number one, oh, it's unfair. They beat me up. You know, can you get that? You know, in that kind of, and you do martial arts, yeah, and you do stuff like that, and you do guitar.
Train harder and come back.
Come back.
Period.
And in thing for me was like, great, I didn't pass anything. So the way this all works is if you don't pass, you're not on the clock. If you pass, you're on the clock. So it used to be you have three years.
To get all three, because there's the technical written stuff.
Yes.
There's the blind tasting, which is, again, identify three whites, three reds, region, varietal, producer, year, ideally.
Yeah.
You get, or be close, really close. And then the service part, which is you. So if once you get one of those,
Your clock starts.
And
you have 2 years.
Two more years to pass the other two. And if you get to three, and I know so many Psalms, I'm not going to mention any names because I love them all. I know so many Psalms that have done it. And just after like the third year and giving up 3 years of their lives, just said, F it. Because now I'm back to square one again.
Yeah.
And maybe I had a baby or my life has moved on.
Exactly.
I'm not doing this anymore.
Yeah. And, you know, I see that a lot. And I've been all over the country and I've seen a lot of people that have faced that particular thing.
Right.
So I got lucky. So I looked at it. So here's how it used to be back in the day. So I got nothing. And so I go to Michael Mina at the time. Yeah, because we did it in San Francisco. I don't go to him personally. So I go to the bar at Michael Mina, and Raj Parr was on the floor then. No, he was the Psalm. He was on the floor. So Richard Betts, Jay Fletcher, Wayne Belding, and like Nunzio Alizotto, who are legendary. These are the dudes. They're sitting at a table.
You're kidding me.
Like right in my, like I'm sitting in the middle of the bar,
and
they're in like the, they're like in the per, they're like right over there in the middle table drinking incredible wines. So Raj comes up to me, and Raj knew me because Michael was looking to open Bourbon Steak. So I had known them because they came in the BLT Steak looking, you know, the R&D thing, right? So I had met them, and so Raj comes up to me. He's like, hey, those guys want to send you some wines. So they send me a flight of wines blind. Right? I nail all the wines, but I'm 10 years off. And I look at Raj. I'm like, come on, dude. I called like 2001 Gruner. It was 1991 Nikolai Hoff, you know, the top level. And I called 1999 Cote Rotin, it was like 85 Gigal La La Dun, and like I was like 10 years off. I was like, this isn't possible, man, because I understand evolution in wine. And he's like, provenance, I get it right from the source. So then I learned that Raj calls up the wineries and he's getting, you know, he's not going through the importer, so on and so forth. And afterwards they came up to me, the master's like, look, so here's something funny. Jay Fletcher comes up to me. He's like, hey, you know, you did a good job, kid. Here's my card if you ever need help. And I knew at that moment that, like, I didn't make the mark, but
you got their attention.
Yeah,
you're on the radar.
I'm on the radar.
Right.
So the next year, I went out to Aspen. And then I went out with Richard Betts, Fletcher. I went out to the Little Nell, which is a bastion of this kind of like mentoring, which we call a stage. If you want to talk about a stagiaire on your show,
right,
you can talk
thing.
About a stage where you go and you just kind of work for free.
Yeah.
And by the way, working for, you know, if you pay for your flight to Aspen and you get to stay in the Little Nell at their rate, it's not a bad gig.
No, and then learned underneath the wing of the master, just taste.
Yeah,
taste,
but
taste,
there were two masters there at the Nell at the time, a third now passed, plus Jay Fletcher, plus Damon Ornowski. So I was kind of hugged by the network at that point, but not really directly related to any one person because I was so individualistic. And then I got two parts, so I passed theory, then I passed service at the same time, and I just missed tasting.
Like one wine.
Yeah, so you got to pass. I don't remember the.
They don't tell you what it is either. Anyway.
Well, I remember when I passed tasting the third year, so I went 0-2-1. So zero is like, so back to that point,
right.
Like zero is like a refreshment.
Right.
It was like great. So I'm on the plane. and Madeline Trufan calls me on that same like shitty flip phone from 1998. You know, and she's like, and I was literally flying back to New York, and she's like, Fred. Unfortunately, you did a really good job, but unfortunately, you didn't pass at a master level. You would have been a really strong advanced pass. But I was on the plane, that's what my results were, you know, and that's how it was. Now it's a lot more. It's extremely systematic. It's professorial. It's, I mean, the court of Master Sommeliers now runs like a university. It's everything is dotted. Everything is dialed. And to get in is really difficult. And it's not about getting in. It's about passing these tests and, you know, having, I mean, the advanced course, like 700 or so people signed up for the advanced that passed the certified, but we can only accept 150 because we just can't, you know, it's mm. very, now it's elite to get to level three. It used to be, you know, like, it's crazy because there's just...
And there is this great interest. I talk about this a lot on the show that, you know, there was a trip to Bordeaux a couple of years ago that was funded by the CIVB, and Patrick Capiello had picked a bunch of Psalms, and he curated them. And it was all these young guys and girls that were all, like, between 22 and 31. The guy from Bestia in San Francisco, what's her name from here, the realtor... she worked for John Georges. She worked for Forgione. Anyway, just so I'm hanging out with all these young kids, and they were so effing smart. Like, how did you like? This is like a new generation of 20 somethings. But I mean, you were like the original OG of that because that was what you were doing at that time. I was but when you were doing it, nobody was doing that.
I was 23. I would say that. Yeah, I was. I moved.
Why wasn't that Malvasia? Isn't Malvasia normally more floral, more expressive? Is that just? That because that was really I really like that. Normally I don't like Malvasia. I'm kind of thinking
It does have floral. It does have a little.
But it
bit
wasn't
of
like over the top.
No, it was
like
more
Torontes.
Saline salt. No.
Yeah,
no,
I thought this
no,
one
no,
was
no.
saline too, but I'm not going to say saline
no,
anymore.
No. This is Torontes and Malvasia. Nothing
right,
like,
and
new with each other.
Even Viognier. I'm not like those are grapes. I'm not crazy about.
So you need to calibrate your Malvasia palate here because it does have a touch of floral, but this is more about yellow fruits, plum. And then, you know, this kind of saline, salty, it's grown in the Adriatic coast in Pula. So it's got more of this in its tank. It's
delicious.
It's crusher wine. I mean, delicious. This is oyster wine. When you're on the beach, cracking oysters, roasting clams, whatever you're doing. And this one here, so I brought you something. So the next wine here, we'll just go into. This is Fascina. This is new to me.
New to me, too.
The producer's new, but this is...
What's Fascina? It's new to me. The whole thing's new to me.
Fascina is from Etna, so it's Etna Bianco. So it's Caracante and Cararo.
So I knew Caracante. That's what I always think of with Etna Bianco.
But this stuff is, like, mind-blowing. It's going on all volcanic stuff. It's got texture and weight and complexity and oxidation. And it's, like, to me, this is, like, super-duper fun. So, you know, we started with the Ziggy Rosé. Then we go into the Trapan, Croatian, you know, oyster white wine. And now we're in something that you can, like, really sink your teeth into as far as, like, like contemplative, you know, we're now pushing into that contemplative zone of wine. It's not white Burgundy, but you know,
it's delicious. I was at it for the first time a couple of years ago. Some really good stuff going on.
Yeah. Well, back to the mentorship.
1 second. Hold on for 1 second. I want to get to that. We need a break for a commercial in the middle of the show. We only have one commercial. It's 2 minutes long. We're going to roll that tape and be back with Fred Dexheimer in approximately 90 seconds or less. Hey folks, Mike Colomeco here. Everybody knows that great cooking really starts with great ingredients, and these days we have so many options to choose from. Well, I go back to the Colavita family brand for years, and there really is a Colavita family behind this brand. I got their story long after I started using their products. Back in the mid-80s, when I was the chef at the Ritz-Carlton here in New York City, one of the things you can do as a chef is order your own food. You do the purchasing, and we switched olive oils to Colavita. When I had my own restaurant down in Cape May, New Jersey, the Globe, for years, that's all we ever poured at the table. That's all I ever cooked with. And then when I started my PBS show in 1999, I thought, you know, if I'm going to look after underwriting and funders, why don't I go after products that I actually use at home, that I actually cook for my family with and in my restaurant with. I've been working with them for 15 years with the PBS series and now with Heritage Radio. The Colavita family goes back generations in Italy. They make their olive oil from great sourced olives, traceable sourced olives, just south of Rome in Molise province, Abruzzo, which is where my family hails from. Since then, their family's moved here, so there's Colavitas living in Rome, Colavitas living in America. It's a great, trusted family brand. It's the olive oil I use, and I recommend you try it as well. Ecstatic vision, ecstatic vision, ecstatic vision, ecstatic vision, lost on the one letter. Do you want to be doing something
fun.
We're back doing something fun. For the next time, we're eating pizza. So if you hear the sound of chewing, for the next, you haven't had a piece yet.
I'll have a piece.
So I'm going to do this. Well, Fred eats, because I'm not going to ask him a question. I'm going to time this. So eat slowly. So we get in that story about the Master Sign thing, which is funny. So the other day, Fred posted on Facebook to his friends a question. And it was a general thing. He said, hey, all my Facebook wine friends, what's your number one hot button issue dealing with winemaking, vineyards, service? The only caveat is, let's not talk too much about, or at all, about natural wines or orange wines, because that's like a whole other discussion.
That's what they're going to say anyway.
Well, half of them ignored that, which is correct. About one third of them were about natural.
Well, that's a whole other point. Read the fine print, my friends.
So, all right, I got to put this pizza down.
You need to have this Alianico, by the way, with the pizza, because it's Campania. But you're in Sicily, so you're close. But this wine,
across a little bit of water between them, and that water between Sicily and Campania is some of the best sword fishing water on planet Earth.
Yeah,
my fishermen friends tell me that. Oh man, this is delicious. I haven't had a taste of it yet. So tell me about this wine. Tell me about the producer. Tell me about why.
Well, this is Montevetrano, which is one of the icons of, and kind of the rule breakers. It's super Tuscan, super Campanian wine. But Montevetrano is one of those wines that's Alianico, Merlot, Cabernet. So it broke the mold of the traditional
grape
varieties.
Is.
But this is their baby wine. It's called Core. Kind of probably $30 retail, but Campania. So we're here at Roberta's, and when I think about Roberta's, I mean, I know there's incredible food beyond pizza, but I come here for pizza, and I come here for specifically a Naples style margarita,
ridiculous pizza.
Style pizza, you know, bufala, San Marzano tomatoes.
Yeah, we're having the margarita right now. The basic
margarita
model.
So I brought a Campanian wine, perfectly suited, and then I brought the Sicilian wine. So like we're right here in the heart of where pizza is. So Sicily, Campania. And this wine to me is like one of those, like, just, you know, I eat a lot of red sauce food. I love cooking meatballs and bolognese and, I love making sofrito, anything I could cook with sofrito and put some put some meat and tomatoes into and cook for six hours.
Right.
You know,
we're good to go.
That's one of the mother sauces. We'll go back to that.
So you passed two of the three. You got the service. You got the technical part down. Now you got to do the tasting.
So the tasting was funny because back to Laura Manick, you know, we were there in San Francisco and I was telling, so I did a blind tasting with some kids today, and it was kind of funny. So I get to the hotel, and they were running a bit late because that happens in exam situations, you know, like sometimes it takes a little longer, things don't go well, and when you're on their side of it. So the master comes down, forget who it was, but he's like, hey, Fred, we need 10 minutes. We'll call you up in 10 minutes. And so I was like, all right. So I go to the bar of the hotel, mm-hmm. and I'm like, oh, there's Albarino, there's Vouvray, there's all these wines that are problematic blind tasting wines,
yeah.
i.e. neutral high acid white wines without oak. So what does that mean?
Because there was in that psalm, wasn't one of the guys confusing when they were going back afterwards? What? You thought it was an Albarino? I thought it was a Vouvray. What are you talking about? I remember going, oh my God. And these are like the best of the best. And that was, I could be wrong, but I think those were the two that they were confusing. So keep going. I'll shut up.
Yeah, yeah. So I ordered like $100 and buy the glass wine.
Before yours?
Yeah, I had 10 minutes. So I just said, can I get a glass of these five? And I went ding, 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 ding. Go up, do my exam. You know, I felt pretty confident. Because I really thought the second time I was going to do what's called the Schlitz Cup. So if you pass all three at once, it's called the Krug Cup. Like, that's like a very rarefied thing. I think 10 people or 15 people,
right.
Like, you know, 6% of people, Krug Cup.
Right.
There was only one master that I know of. Maybe there's more now, but Joe Spellman in Chicago, who works with Justin and worked with Charlie Trotter back in the day. He was the only one that went O and then three. Like, which is a huge thing, because if you struck out the first round and then you clean the deck, that's like, you know, you're in a slump, you're 0-4, and then you come back and hit like
Grand
three home
bases,
like,
loaded ninth.
Yeah, like you pull a Reggie Jackson in like the 77 World Series with the Yankees and you hit three, and you know, that's kind of how magnificent that kind of feat is. And I was like, and everyone was, but back then it was like, we're talking 2006, we're talking like 11 years ago, everyone's like, yeah, he's going to do it. And I was like feeding into that energy, and I just missed tasting by just this, you know, a skosh. I think they'll maybe tell me different. But when I went to the tasting the last time, I had 10 minutes. So I was like, let's taste some wines. So the message is sometimes you have to prime yourself. You know, sometimes you take a shot before you go on the air. You have rituals, right? Like you meditate before you go on camera or you take a shot. Everybody has a ritual. Tony Robbins has a ritual that he does when he goes on stage.
So they come downstairs 10 minutes later. You whisk upstairs in the elevator. You're sitting at the table.
I looked at the wines.
Three
said,
reds, three whites.
Yeah, three reds, three
whites.
A couple
guys sitting across from you. You have 23 minutes.
25.
25 minutes.
25 minutes.
Bang.
Bang. Go.
How'd it go?
It's the shortest 25 minutes of your life.
I bet.
And
so a couple of them were easy.
No, none of them were easy.
None of them were easy.
No.
So you, what do you do? Like color first, then the nose, then back to color, then
yeah,
the nose.
Yeah. So well, there's different ways to do it, and if I had to do it over, I would do it differently. Even though I passed,
because it's this like deductive style.
Yeah. So you have six wines. So you know I was telling this student today. You know, you got to size them up. Size them up, man. Like, take the time when you're sitting there, when they're telling you instructions.
Start looking.
Size up the table and look at color.
Right.
Look at what's golden.
Right. What's green?
What's green?
Gold,
what's platinum?
Wait, what's
that's so, white.
Oh, right.
What's darker red? Darker white. So golden is a dark white. So more oxidative. If, you know, a wine with a pale color, that's probably a young wine.
Right.
Red wines, the more paler, the older, the more like brick tawny. But if something's like violet purple, that's a young wine with a lot of extraction. So you got to like size up the table, and you know it's like a game. Like you gotta figure out who you're gonna take out first. You know, like that's why I look at it as a now. Okay. I look at it very differently. So now I look at it in a sense of like combat, or like, you know, I'm in a street fight or something. I'm like,
well, we can share that. That's a good way to put it.
Yeah, you got to like look at who's the weakest,
right,
who's and gonna, take them out first.
Who am I dropping first, and where do I turn next?
Yeah, so that's the first thing, and that's color. That's without even picking up a glass. You know, so then you pick up the glass, but then you got to like, you can't just pick up the first glass. You got to look at, because what happens is you go down, end up in a rabbit hole. So let's say wine number one. You start with wine number one. There's six wines, and three of them are white. And you go through, you look at it, it's pale straw, it's this, and all of a sudden you invent that it's Sancerre and Sauvignon Blanc.
And in your head.
And you got the blinders on and this myopic, you know, this total myopic view. And then you get to wine number two and you're like, fuck, that's Sancerre. Now what's one? So you got 25 minutes.
Right.
And, you know, so you gotta like, you have to have a strategy. It's like chess, you know. Like what I learned about chess is, and I didn't learn until later in life, is the Bobby Fischer thing. The Bobby Fischer thing is I always use to move the pawns. No, you move the knights and you attack the middle of the board. That's so you gotta attack the middle of the board. Uh-huh. Take knight to e4, uh-huh. Take knight to e5, and...
So was there like a specific glass, the red or the white, that you were, it was coming down to like, I'm not 100% sure of this.
Yeah, there was an Italian wine. I there was two wines. There was a wine that Vouvray. I don't know if it was a Riesling or Vouvray. And I don't know
so
if
it was confusing Riesling and Vouvray.
Because there was residual sugar. So to define that, there's two white varieties with high acid that tend to have residual sugar.
So it's either
Chenin or Riesling. So that was one. And the other one.
Was there any petrol in the nose of the Vouvray? Was it a Vouvray?
I can't. It was 11 years ago, man.
Okay. All right.
I passed.
Right. Done. Whatever.
So,
you got it.
But the other one, and to put your heritage there, it was. It was either Brunello or Barolo, and I got either one of those. One of the two of those I got wrong. I'll never know because they never release. You never get told.
You're correct.
You never get told
what it
you,
was.
You it's pass or perfect. No pass.
Right.
It's not fail. It's pass, or you didn't pass. There's no. We don't use the F word. They don't, because it, you know, it's politically correct. No pass.
Brunello and Barolo. I mean, they're so.
Well, I could tell you how that works.
Tell me.
Tannin. Nebbiolo has more tannin than Sangiovese. But it was a super-duper high-quality wine. All the reds were like 10 to 20 years old. So imagine tasting. So I think one was a Rioja, one was a Bordeaux, and one was either Brunello or...
And you had to get the vintage?
You had to
or
be
close.
Like...
You, had like to you be, can't confuse like 05 with 04 or 10
well,
with 9.
So
9 was super hot in Bordeaux and 10 was a whole other story.
Yeah, I mean... yes, that's important. But at the end of the day, what we're looking for, because I'm an examiner now.
Right, right. Talk. What you're looking for is?
What we're looking for is, do you have a concept of what the wine is?
An understanding of?
Of what the wine is.
Right. Here's how this grape in this terroir, in this style, presents itself.
Et cetera, et cetera, et cetera.
What are the markers? How did you get that?
And then you have to get the variety. So let's say that you have to get the variety, region, country. So let's say I called it Brunello di Montalcino. It's from central Italy, from Tuscany. It's a high quality wine because it's Brunello. You can't call it Brunello quality wine because Brunello's, and for your listeners, Brunello's for closers, you know. Brunello's for ballers.
It would be Rosso di Montalcino or something else. If it was same grape varietal from a lesser appellation.
Yeah, so you got to understand the lingo, right?
Right.
Like you're saying all this stuff and like it's complex and all these things. But the marker for that really is the higher tannin. But if you're in Italy, high quality, you really understand what's going on in the glass, but it's Nebbiolo Barolo, you're not like failing. You understand the concept.
Yeah.
You just missed the fact that there was more tannin.
Yeah.
And you missed the fact that there was a little bit more of an aromatic component that was a little different. And a texture. Maybe it's texture. Like, to me, I'm a textural.
No, Pasca talks about that all the time. Because every time I go to Rouge, all the times I've gone, I always ever blind taste me just to humiliate myself. And, you know, sometimes I'm not going to do the year of the producer, but if I can get the grape and the region, I'm thrilled. And then, like, the other day, I was there for a while. I don't drink a lot of Pinot Noir because it's kind of expensive, and I don't drink a lot of domestic American wines for whatever reason. And I don't drink a lot of Burgundy because it costs too much money. So she poured a Pinot for me, and it was three of us, my son and another wine person. And, you know, I'm thinking, I love these feminine, it was light, it could be Ruche, it could be Nerello Mascalese, it could be, yes, I'll view this glass. Anyway, I was wrong, but I was in, like, the right playing field.
Well, here's what I think about blind tasting now, and I didn't really tell you what I'm doing now, so I'm the national wine educator.
Tell me about this. This is the latest thing. So Fred was, like, a star in New York, who just kind of decamped to go to Asheville or North Carolina?
I moved down to the Triangle.
Raleigh-Durham.
Yeah, Triangle, yeah.
And there was a restaurant. I would see on Facebook, there was a restaurant you were involved with. There was a video you sent me once. It was really cool. You're cooking some of this dude.
Juice bar, coffee shop.
And all of a sudden,
garden,
Fred's coming
bar.
Back, and we're all like, stoked, welcome home, dude. That's how it kind of feels like. Fred's back.
I'm home.
And you're at Winebow. So tell me what you're doing. Tell us who Winebow is for those of you who don't know the name.
So I'll just say that there are the most amazing serendipities in life and happy accidents. And so I work with Winebow Group. They in New York, it's Winebow Group and Martin Scott. But around the country, we have an amazing presence of some of the greatest wines in the world. That's what Mike and I are tasting here. We have some of the greatest wines in the world, and I get to be the National Education Director. So right now I'm trying to carve and create a national education program that will ripple through 20 states, 25 different distributors, as well as servicing and, like, you know, teaching the kids on the street here in New York and New Jersey, Pennsylvania, how to sell wine more effectively.
Is this a new position?
It's a new position.
Right, so they, like, carved this space out for you, figuring...
Well, they carved the space out for someone. I got lucky.
But you're a great communicator. You know your shit. You can train people. I've seen you in groups of people before. Yeah. You speak like regular language. It's not like, oh my God, I'm yawning too. No, I get it. There's like a level of energy that's exciting. You draw people in.
Yeah. Well, that's what you basically got me the gig, right? So I've been an independent. I've worked on my own for about 8 years and worked with wines of Chile, wines of Southwest France, wines of Toro, Macedonia, Croatia. Laurent Torrendel, I worked with. He's my chef. Like, when you have a chef, that's home. And I would say my chef is Laurent, unequivocally. I've worked with great hotels, Omni. I've worked with Grand Hyatt. I've had amazing clients. But this gig came up, and it was like, this is the next level. I turned 40.
How'd it come to you?
Little birdie. Just was like, hey, Fred, you should go talk to this person. And I was like, I'm fine.
One of those things, seriously.
You know how this works, right? Like, how are you at Heritage Radio? It was like, how are you in Brooklyn as a New Jersey guy, right? Like, just by, you know. So, yeah, and then I did the interview, and I did a process, and I met people, and I did I presented stuff, and they were just like, yeah, he's the guy. And you know, and there were a lot of good people. And
so here we are. Doing travelings, tastings.
Well, no, my focus right now is just to be in New York and learn the company, okay. Right? So I'm a company guy, Mike.
I saw Wolfgang the other day doing a tasting with their staff.
Yeah, so, you know, like...
It's a great room, isn't it?
It's amazing.
Those Gustavino tiles.
By the way, that room is powerful. Those guys, the service guys there, have been there since day one.
Yeah, it's like Luger on this side of the bridge.
Exactly.
Because the kid that runs it, his dad was a lifer as a server. He might have been the maitre d' at Luger.
Yeah.
When he went to retire, the kid was on kind of in the skids. The kid's like, it was one of those stock market recessions. And the kid's like, Dad, let's open a restaurant. The dad's like, dude, I'm effing retiring. No, let's open a restaurant.
And they have like six, you know.
They've done
really
well.
So I did a favor for our team. You know, they had a couple wines in there. And I was like, I'll go do it. And I basically walked out with a picture, a pint of beer, a bunch of high fives, and they were like, thank you so much. We, you know, these are like, you know,
lifers.
Armenian guys, yeah, like Eastern, you know, former Yugoslavia guys. And they're like, you talk about wine the way we think. You like you said, you make sense of it. Like, this is what you need to know. Here's the wine. Yeah. Here's what it feels like. Here's what it tastes like. Here's how to relate it to other things. So it was, you know, but I do all
what
kinds.
Are we drinking? This is delicious.
This is called Antu Anima Negra. So these are these crazy dudes who are on Mallorca, and this is Calet, and I think maybe Lista Negra or something. But it's Antu. These guys, I mean, pretty cool stuff. It's you know, this is from Mallorca, and you know, I brought you some fun stuff, but these are all. So, no, yeah, I'm not Mr. Natural, I'm not Mr. Orange, I'm not Mr. Organic, I'm not Mr. Dynamic.
Which means I've got to get you back before the end of June before I leave.
But here's the deal with these. These are just wines I think are cool, I like, I think they're unique.
Yeah,
they represent the variety and the place that they're from really well. I don't have any MO other than that. I want to have, like, clean, delicious, beautiful wine that represents, you know, and also in a price point.
Yeah, okay.
So all these wines are $20 to $30 retail, maybe even below.
So these could be by the glass wines for
restaurants. Yeah, these would be like you could have this Malvasia by the glass. This the Ziggity, I think that has a big potential.
That's ridiculous.
The rosé at like $12
delicious.
In a restaurant.
What a way to start
crush,
the night.
Yeah. Crush.
Rather than having a cocktail before dinner, a glass of that, keep your palate fresh.
Crush.
Delicious.
Yeah.
We got to get you back because we never got. I mean, I actually, look, I had a list of things I was going to ask you. And you know how many I asked you? The first one. That was the best one. It was a good one because I got your story. That's all I really wanted to get out of this with the Fred Deck story.
Well, the story's great, Mike. I really appreciate it.
Oh, no.
Great wines.
Thank you. You'll come back. I'm really, between now and the end, I only do this till the end of June. Then I take summers off to live at the beach for 3 months. So,
well,
yes.
I want your schedule. And we got to go, by the way, we got to go see Bill Frisell. And for your listeners, Bill's one of the first guitarists I ever saw in New York City at the Village Vanguard.
And
I almost lost my wife. To be, because she was like, get me out of here. This music is hurting my ears.
He's an acquired taste. He's really intellectual. There's not a lot. It's very, you got to love Bill.
Favorite guitarist?
Oh, man. I'm not going to answer that because I have too many. But I'll say this about Bill Frisell.
Top three.
What I love about Bill Frisell is that he sort of, and I said this 20 years ago when I first heard him, he was like the Jim Hall of the new generation of jazz guitarists.
Yeah.
A guy that didn't crush you with his technique. It wasn't Pat Martin, it wasn't Matheny, it wasn't Schofield. They're all great. It wasn't John.